It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In the United States, a law enforcement officer is injured or killed in the line of duty every 33 minutes. But there exists no annual counting of seriously injured officers. A documentary called Heroes Behind the Badge, Sacrifice and Survival, directed by British Academy Award-winning filmmaker Wayne Derrick and narrated by Law & Order's Vincent D'Onofrio, is telling the stories of some of those officers, including Clerton Police Patrolman James Cusack. 3 years ago tomorrow, Officer Cusack was responding to a home invasion call in Clerton. Upon arrival, Officer Cusack was shot 5 times and critically wounded by 2 suspects as they fled the scene. Today, he is paralyzed from the waist down. He joins us now in Studio A. Jim Cusack, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
Heroes Behind the Badge will have its Pittsburgh premiere Saturday at the Hyundai West Club Lounge at Heinz Field at 7 p.m. Also joining us is Brian Drusky of Drusky Entertainment, who is bringing the film to Pittsburgh. Brian Drusky, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
Jim Cusack, time can be a deceptive measurement. Does it feel like it's been 3 years since you were shot, 3 years since you were able to walk?
No, it literally seems to me like it was a last week kind of thing. You've been through so much, but I'm so accustomed to my life right now that I don't feel like anything's been different. You know, I've adjusted quite well to where I'm at. You know, the wheelchair is just another way for me to get around instead of walking. You know, sometimes it's better, sometimes it's not, especially when there's snow. I don't have 4-wheel drive, so I have to kind of get around the best I can. But no, time is both fleeting, but it's also can make things seem so much longer. So when the days that I have a lot of extreme pain and I can't get through makes my day miserable and long. But other days, it's, you know, here we are 3 years later.
What do you remember about what happened on April 4th, 2011 and the call you received that day? That might be the best place to start.
I pretty much remember everything vividly. I never lost consciousness, which is hard for a lot of people to believe. They don't understand how, you know, you go through this and you remember everything. But I'd been working the 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. shift. We'd answered a couple calls. My partners, Matt McDaniel and John Steiner, we'd been running around, domestics, things like that. And we got this call, and it came in more as of a disturbance in a duplex. And the caller was the neighboring persons. We arrived on scene, and we knew how to get there. We wanted to get there as silently and stealthily as possible. So we blacked out the cars, turning our lights out. And then we all decided we know what we were doing. We had enough law enforcement experience on approaching the house. You know, I ended up going to the back door. We had the front door and a back door to worry about. So John went to the front. Matt took the side with, he had a long rifle with him so that we kind of could cover a large area. So I went to the back door. And when I approached the back door, there's a very small deck with 4 steps that go up to it. I walked up to it and I saw that the door was cracked. And as soon as I tried to announce myself as Clerton Police, door slammed shut. So I backed away. I notified Matt and John that, hey, I had contact in the back. Well, not knowing that this was anything but an unusual disturbance, I was going to approach the door again to try and make contact. So I had my weapon out at the ready, 1, 2, 3, 4 steps up onto the deck. And as soon as I hit that 4th step and both my feet hit the deck, the white steel door became a black void. The door opened up, and then the next thing I saw was an orange muzzle flash, and it was the first shot. And that's when time becomes slow motion. Having trained in a lot of shooting scenarios and teaching SWAT courses and stuff like that, you know, we understand what the adrenaline dump does to you and what it does to your body. So things start to happen. You start to get auditory exclusion. You lose fine muscle control. Everything's just big, large movements because the blood is pooling from the outer extremities into the center of the chest. And I now realize I'm being shot. But in my mind, I'm like, why aren't I shooting back? What I didn't know was the first shot was the one that struck me in my right forearm, which then took my firearm from me. It literally just caused my hand to open and my weapon went away.
And just to clarify for people, there were 5 shots. You were wearing a bulletproof vest. So,
yes.
And 2 of the shots hit the vest, but there were 3 that penetrated your body. So one was in – it was your right
– the first one entered the mid-right forearm, and that would have been my gun hand. So the next 2, we believe, went directly across my chest, across my body, and he struck the vest and continued on. We actually found one of those projectiles on the deck itself, which actually matched the ballistics from the bullet we removed from my arm. Now, the fourth shot was the one that entered my left chest area, a little short of my left nipple area. What I didn't know at the time was that it actually had gone through my entire bullet-resistant vest. It didn't just go around. It had gone through it. That's the area of the vest that they don't test because it can't dissipate the trauma and the force of the bullet striking. So it did go through. Well, that bullet went through, tore through my left lung, damaged it heavily, traveled the length of my body all the way across my spine at the T11 where it caused the paralysis. And then the fifth bullet went underneath my my left armpit.
When you approach the back door of the house, you know it's a dangerous situation. What makes you go up those stairs?
That's what I do. You know, I've done this job. At the time, I'd been a police officer for 18 years. I had been in situations where I was a narcotics detective. You know, we had been entry teams on serving warrants. You go through the door. The idea is to secure the subjects, secure the evidence. It's something we know we do. We know that there's danger to it. You just hope for the best that you've trained well enough for it and in anticipation of it. But when you get in a situation where I was, it's an ambush situation. That person on the other side of the door knew ahead of time what they were going to do in anticipation of my actions. I had no idea. I have rules of engagement. They don't. So when I walked up those steps, yeah, I had a firearm, but I didn't have the ability to identify anybody, and I couldn't identify a target because I never saw who shot me. I just saw a very large black void and a muzzle flash.
So you're taken to Mercy Hospital. What happened after that?
I remember the ambulance ride. I remember everything going through that. I remember my partner carrying me out from the house, getting the ambulance. We go all the way to Mercy. What I didn't know was that the weather had taken a turn for the worse. They said it was one of the worst downpours of rain that day. They even were intending to fly me through Stat Medevac, and they wouldn't fly. So that's what the ambulance ride. We got to the ER. I remember being pushed in the ER, seeing the trauma surgeon, him asking me, you know, what hurt and everything. And I told him, I says, pretty much right now my butt hurts. I don't know why. There's a pain in my right side. I can't tell you. And then all of a sudden everything went white. I at that point didn't know if it was, okay, I'm going to see the light. I didn't know if I'm going to wake up. And then when I did wake up, it was sometime later, would have been Tuesday morning, and I woke up intubated in the ICU, seeing Chris, my parents, and everybody standing around.
What kind of therapy were you doing immediately after being paralyzed?
I spent 10 days in the ICU, and then we directly went into the next 37 days of inpatient therapy at the spinal cord floor, 7th floor of Mercy Hospital. Wonderful people. They made me start on the right road to accept what I was dealing with. And for some reason, my mind really took grasp of it. It wasn't like a shock to the point where you're never going to walk, you can't do this. It was all right, let's get on. And we did the therapy was twice a day. It was, you know, basically how do you function with not having the power of your legs to move you? And it's something weird. You know, when you can't move something, you're looking at it, it's the same, you feel it the same, except for there's not the same feeling. You're telling it to move and your brain's going, yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
And what kind of physical therapy are you doing now? Has it changed in the nature of it in the last 3 years?
We did 1 year, which we were going to UPMC Southside, doing actual hands-on physical therapy and up and walking in braces, the KFOs. And then we switched from that to Harmerville South, Health South in Harmerville, which was using the auto ambulator, which they'll see in the documentary, which is actually a machine. It stands me up, moves my legs in a walking motion on a treadmill.
Those are really amazing scenes.
Yeah, it was. I love that machine. As painful as it was. It makes you feel that you're walking again. And the whole time we were doing that, we were also going through aquatic therapy, which I still do two days a week, where I get into a pool that's 90 degrees in temperature, and I do exercises and I actually walk. You get in 5 foot of water, I'm buoyant, and I just basically put a brace on one leg and I use my right leg that I can move, and I just start walking across the pool.
How far do you think that you can take your rehab? Do you think that you might be able to walk again?
Yes. I don't think there's anything going to stop me. The only thing is, here we go with time again. I've learned patience. Patience is a virtue I did not have early on, but I have gained right now. You know what? I take that little feeling or that little movement I can find every day, and I take hold of it. I'm like, okay, I can maybe control that one little toe a little better. And as it comes, I take it, you know.
What are the doctors telling you?
They don't. Basically, what they were told is that day of the injury, when I was in the hospital, they said to my parents and to Chris, they said, right now, if Jim survives the next 48 hours, that will be the deciding factor, and that's an if. And if he does survive, he'll never walk again. Plain and simple, blunt, right to the point, and which that, when I was told, pretty much collapsed my father in his footsteps and my mother and Chris. And, you know, I mean, how do you deal with that? You know, I went to work on Monday night, and next thing you know, later Monday evening, they get the call that I'm shot, and now he's never going to walk again. So I don't really listen to them. I more or less go with what my body tells me and with what I can do.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about a documentary, and it's called Heroes Behind the Badge. It features the story of the gentleman that we're talking with now, injured Clareton police officer James Cusack, a documentary that'll have its Pittsburgh premiere Saturday at the Hyundai West Club Lounge at Heinz Field at 7 p.m. Also joining us, Brian Drusky of Drusky Entertainment, who's bringing the film to Pittsburgh. And we'll bring Brian into the conversation in just a minute here. But Officer Cusack, you, I know, go through a great deal of pain on a regular basis. How do you deal with that? What is it like for you to go through everyday life?
I've been trying to find a way to describe that to people. It's, I think it comes down to just what mental capacity I have to fight through it. And what I mean by that is, when I wake up in the morning and I get to see Chris and I get to see our dogs and, you know, speak with my mom and my dad on a daily basis, I'm happy. It doesn't matter what kind of pain I have or how I feel that day. I'm here. I get to have that feeling. So that's a plus. Now, since we had this cold weather for so long, it was really difficult. You know, that affects me greatly. The spasticity in my legs causes a lot of pain. I have a lot of nerve pain that you describe that as a pain that the nerves don't commonly reach the brain, so then that creates a static that causes a pain. I have that every day in my legs. And then I also have a reoccurring spasm in my left lower abdomen area that we can't control. And I try and just sit there and take it as it comes for the minute or the moments or the half hours that it lasts. And then I look on to what I get to do for the rest of the day. It hasn't beaten me. I don't plan on letting it beat me. So I just I push through it. There hasn't been a good way to describe the pain to tell anybody. I just don't want anybody to – I don't want anybody to have to feel what I feel. It's something I carry. It's my burden that I carry because I want to be here. Other people that I've now met and I am involved with in the spinal cord injury world, they understand. Weather is our enemy. Any little things can affect us, you know, in our days. And, you know, a lot of things go along with a spinal cord injury that just you don't understand. And why would you expect people to? I didn't know it until I was involved in it. So my days are my days. I deal with it so that I can, you know, get out there and come here and talk to people and get everything out there so that I can show people that it's not the end of a life. It's just a different way.
What sort of you certainly, as I talk to you, and I'm sure people get the impression as they listen to this conversation, that you have adjusted well to your situation. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about – there must be some sort of psychological trauma associated with this incident that you still are dealing with. And if so, what is it?
Sure. When we first got out of the hospital and continued physical therapy, they equated to the post-traumatic stress syndrome. And a lot of it came to anytime I was hearing loud sounds that I wasn't ready for, it would cause me to kind of flash back into the moment. You get a hypervigilance about yourself. The heart rate increases, and you get that scared feeling where you become so alert, but you can't come down from it. I had that for a while. We used counseling through Victims of Violent Crime to help us get through that, and it worked very well. Any more or less, what I'll get is maybe a nightmare, you know, some things like that. I'll do my best to hopefully wake up from it and calm myself down. I had a lot of training in it beforehand, and a lot of the survival training I had taken through Caliber Press Street Survival, a lot of the trainings I did, we had a program called Battle Buddies and talking people through it. So I guess I was a little more prepared prior to this. And what I get now, more or less than anything, is I get a feeling when I see other police officers that have been shot or I hear about the stories, and I stay on top of that as much as I can, is when I see that they're killed, how easily that could have been me. And I try and speak to the people that I meet that have lost a loved one and tell them I know what was on their mind at the time that they died, because it was very easily for the same for me the day that I was shot. I knew laying there and sitting there while this had occurred, because I was awake, that how difficult it was to breathe because my left lung had collapsed. I said, I knew that if I would just exhale, close my eyes, and just be at that point, I was very peaceful, and I knew that I'm okay with it. But I wasn't okay with it. I didn't want to go. There was no way I was going to go. But it was a very odd and peaceful feeling at the time. I didn't feel any pain. I just knew that I had people there for me, and I knew that I had to see them again, and I wasn't going to let that happen.
The two suspects who did this to you,
mm-hmm.
They were found not guilty of shooting you. You went through a whole trial with
yes.
two individuals. What's it like to try to achieve some level of closure when you know that the people responsible for this got away with this particular charge?
It was a very hard pill to swallow. Having sat there for 5.5 weeks for this process, I wouldn't say it was easy for me, but having been through trials in my career, it was more difficult, I think, for my family and everybody else, because they'd never been through it. They've never understood what the process is and what's required of it. But yeah, to sit there and get the ultimate verdict and hear that the one gentleman was convicted of being there, the attempted homicide on the family, the attempted rape, the theft, the burglary, the impersonating a federal officer, everything there convicted of, but then, oh, wait, he didn't, you know, shoot you. That was just, it took a while to process. And then to find the other gentleman completely just acquitted of all, that he wasn't even there, when, you know, everything that we have as believing in the investigators, the investigators did this case, did everything possible they could, and they are tops. I mean, the Allegheny County Police, you know, on top of every other agency that was involved, the DEA, everybody, ATF, all these agencies, they worked this case as hard as they could. But when you have 12 persons sitting there and on a jury trying to come to a conclusion, that's a hard thing to accomplish. So it was hard. It took me a little bit to equate that they may not have been found guilty, but why should I carry that burden? If I carry that burden with me every day, that's just something that's going to eat away at me every day and not allow me to move on with my life. It happened. You know, fortunately, the person that I believe shot me is in jail for 50 to 100 years. So hopefully he won't be able to harm anybody else. And, you know, that's my goal as a police officer, so that doesn't affect anybody else.
We're talking with Officer James Cusack, who is the subject of a documentary called Heroes Behind the Badge. We'll give you some details on when that's showing, but Brian Dresky of Dresky Entertainment is here. Dresky Entertainment is bringing the film to Pittsburgh. And Brian, why is it so important to you to bring this film to Pittsburgh?
I am very pro-police. a lot of my family and a lot of my really good friends are police officers, so it's something that's near and dear to my heart. So, this is something that a friend of mine who's a City of Pittsburgh police officer, Keith Stover, he mentioned to me that there was another movie coming out about this. He went to the first one when they premiered it in Bethel Park, I think, last year. And I kind of looked into it and met all the people involved with it, with Jim and Bill Uferth, who is the producer of the movie. And, you know, we worked out the idea to bring it and made it this weekend for a reason, because it's obviously 3 years for Officer Kuzik getting injured and 5 years for to the weekend of the three slain Pittsburgh police officers. So there was a reason why we did it this weekend. And, you know, we want to kind of – I try to help to get the word out there, you know, about helping, you know, police officers and their family. I did the Fallen Not Forgotten concerts five years ago, obviously, with the three slain Pittsburgh police officers, where we raised money for their families and memorial funds, and did a couple more for Officer Crosshaw's family and Officer Kotecki's family. So this is an important it's important to me, and this is all the money. There's no money being made by us or me. It's all going to the National Law Enforcement Memorial Fund for this. So this is not a for-profit gain for me. This is all charity-driven, you know, which is something I like to do.
And again, the film is showing at the Hyundai West Club Lounge at Heinz Field at 7 p.m. on Saturday. Jim Cusack, what do you hope people will take away from this documentary?
I hope they come to see the movie so that they understand that the police officer you see in that uniform isn't that person you feared, isn't that person you need to be worried about. It's the person you need to look up to and say thank you. And to say this is what they may have to deal with, or their family may have to deal with, that they may not come home. And if they do come home injured, that this may be the life they have to lead. And that they do this for you in exactly that way. It's for you. That's why it's called public safety. You know, if it wasn't for the police officers, the firefighters, the paramedics, EMS, there would be no line of safety for you. You know, these are the people you call, and this is who shows up. So I hope they can gain an appreciation for what we do.
Officer James Cusack, Brian Drusky, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh today.